Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the Mobilities and Methods series. The series is hosted by the New Books Network in association with the Mobilities and Methods Lab at the University of Illinois at Chicago. I'm your host, Aliza Arıcan. My guest today is Osman Balkan, Associate Director of the Huntsman Program in International Studies and Business at the University of Pennsylvania. We'll be talking about his book, Dying Abroad, The Political Afterlives of Migration in Europe, published recently by Cambridge University Press. Thank you very much, Osman, for joining us today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for your invitation.
Of course, the pleasure is all mine. So let's start by getting to know you. How did you arrive at political science, at ethnography, and at an ethnographic book on death and migration?
Well, this book started as a dissertation that I wrote in the political science department at the University of Pennsylvania, but I think the seeds of my interest in questions around migration and citizenship, race, transnationalism, and the politics of borders and boundaries really grew out of my own life experience as a second-generation immigrant whose formative years were spent back and forth between the United States and Turkey. My parents moved here. I was born in the States, but my whole life was back and forth. So I learned a lot about the contingencies and complexities of inclusion and belonging through my own efforts to navigate what it meant to be marked as an other, both in both countries where I grew up. So I was never fully accepted as an American or as a Turk. And I think this experience of being an insider or an outsider, which is an experience that I think is common for many second generation immigrants, taught me a lot about the instability of categories such as nation or citizen. And when I first encountered the work of Stuart Hall, as an undergrad at Reed College, I felt as though someone had finally put words to something that I'd been living personally for years. Hall's work on diasporas, on the experience of belonging to more than one world, of being both here and there, about the and about the difficult questions that this creates for one's sense of self and self-identification, were really revelatory for me and have been at the core of my academic work and my scholarly research ever since. Hall shows us, so eloquently, I think, how identity is never singular, how it's multiply constructed across intersecting and antagonistic discourses, practices, subject positions. And he insists in his work that we approach the question of identity not as a set of fixed attributes, but as a constantly shifting process of positioning. And I really like that. His approach helped me make sense of my own liminality, and, you know, if I can call it such, and gave me both a language, but also a set of theoretical and analytical frameworks for understanding the social, political, cultural, and historical processes that have shaped different experiences of transnational migration across the world. So for me, he's remains a key theoretical interlocutor and intellectual companion. He's an author whose work I return to over and over again and assign in almost all of my classes. So that was the kind of big hero number one, I guess. But at Reed, I was fortunate enough to work with a number of great scholars like the political theorist Darius Rejali, the anthropologist Paul Silverstein, and Cambiz Ganea Basiri, who's a scholar of Islam. And being at a liberal arts college, you know, our academic curriculum was quite interdisciplinary. And although I majored in political science as an undergrad, I took courses in anthropology and economics and history, music, comparative literature, all of which was an experience that I tried to recreate when I started my PhD program at Penn. I'm a firm believer in interdisciplinary knowledge production and exchange, which is actually quite achievable in a field like migration studies, which brings scholars from so many different disciplines into conversation with one another. And, you know, maybe it's because of their interest in border crossing and people on the move, that migration scholars are, you know, on the whole, less encumbered with the disciplinary boundaries that tend to keep, you know, knowledge siloed. So I think I found a good home here. And at Penn, as I said, this began as a dissertation project. My committee was comprised of scholars from different subfields in political science. I work with comparative politics people as well as political theorists. And I was lucky that they were pretty open-minded, both about the choice of topic and about my methodological approach. So ethnography is still, I would say, an underutilized methodology in political science, even though we have many exemplary ethnographers in our discipline, you know, people like James Scott, Lisa Wedeen, Timothy Pachirat, Wendy Perlman, just to name a few. And several years ago, I co-founded the American Political Science Association's Political Ethnography Working Group with my friend and fellow ethnographer, Tani Sebro, who's at Cal Poly out in Humboldt. And, you know, ethnographers have long found a home in APSA's interpretive methodologies and methods section. So there is, you know, there are people facilitating these conversations. But in any case, I knew that I wanted to work on questions surrounding immigration, citizenship, and identity in Europe. And having written my undergraduate thesis on Islam and secularism in Turkey and France, I wanted to expand my geographical horizons. So I visited Berlin for the first time on a backpacking trip through Europe in my early 20s. I was completely blown away and enchanted by the neighborhood of Kreuzberg, which, as you know, is one of the epicenters of the Turkish diaspora in Germany, and has a really kind of important part, I think, in the imaginary of Turkish life in Berlin. And I don't have any family connections to Germany, so, you know, no family members who immigrated there. But I wanted to spend more time learning about the experience of Turkish and Kurdish migrants in Berlin, which is how I came to choose my field site. And having worked closely with, you know, anthropologists during both in grads, in undergrad and in grad school, you know, I already had some familiarity with ethnographic writing, and many of the formative books that I read as a younger scholar were these really rich ethnographies of peoples and places. So books that would literally transport the reader into a new world. And I've always been compelled by the power of stories and oral histories, and knew that I wanted to adopt an ethnographic approach in my own work, an approach that would center the voices and meaning-making processes of my interlocutors and interview partners, and which tries to transport the reader into a world that is probably unfamiliar to them. So one of the values, I think, of ethnography lies in the ability to connect micro-level experiences to macro-level structures and processes, right? Illuminating how lived experiences and the meanings that differently positioned actors attribute to them are reflexively shaped by broader and more abstract structural forces. And a key feature of the ethnographic approach is listening to other people. I did my best to enmesh myself into the life worlds of my interlocutors. I didn't always agree with them, and they were often, you know, just as curious about me as I was about them. And one of the challenges for any ethnographer is, you know, establishing trust and rapport. And, you know, maybe this is easier when we recognize that, you know, people aren't simply out there waiting to be the objects of our study, of our ethnographic gaze, but they study us back. You know, they allow us into their lives in calculated ways. But, you know, in any case, I did make some mistakes and had some bizarre encounters in the field that I can speak to more about in a little bit. But it made to me, it made sense to try to write the story of, you know, transnational living and dying ethnographically, since I was quite interested in trying to understand how people managed and made sense of dying in a country where they didn't necessarily feel at home, which is what I call in the book death out of place.
Yeah, thanks so much for, you know, taking us so elegantly through all these places and institutions and ways of thinking that culminated in this book. And I'm excited to talk about the weird and bizarre encounters that happened along the way. But for the moment, I want to talk a bit more about the term that you developed throughout the book, death out of place. Can you tell us more about this concept? And what does death out of place tell us about political membership and belonging?
Right. Okay. So the term death out of place is inspired by my engagement with another diasporic intellectual who, like Stuart Hall, has had an outsized impact on my own intellectual trajectory. And I'm referring here to the great Edward Said, who characterized his own life experience as a life lived out of place. So he wrote this book. It was a memoir. It was called Out of Place. And he writes in the book that from an early age, he has a difficulty reconciling his two selves. So Edward, which was this English name given to him in honor of the Prince of Wales, always seemed disjointed from the Arabic Said. He writes that, you know, this phrase out of place is not simply like a geographical reality, but it for Said, it was an existential condition. His loyalties, his allegiances, his very sense of self were contradictory and confusing, and he felt, as he put it, out of place. And I was really drawn to his beautiful account of liminality and displacement that he chronicles in this memoir. So this is one of the inspirations. And the second one, which will be familiar to anthropologists, of course, you know, comes from the work of Mary Douglas and the classic book Purity and Danger. You know, Douglas argues there that every culture maintains symbolic boundaries that aim to keep categories and groupings pure, which give particular cultures and peoples their unique identities. So what's unsettling is when persons and things do not conform to their ascribed category or ascribed place in the category, right? What she calls matter out of place. And she uses the example of dirt to work through ideas of pollution and hygiene and so on. I developed the concept of death out of place to describe a situation where people come face to face with difficult end-of-life questions in countries where they don't necessarily feel at home. So these people have multiple and sometimes conflicting allegiances, attachments, and loyalties to different places, to different political communities. They may face barriers to inclusion in both the countries where they've settled in and in those countries where they're purportedly from or where they're told to go back to. And the liminality that they experience in life is also present after death, you know, as their family members and survivors make arrangements for their funerals. They try to determine where and how the body will be buried, whether they'll be able to perform religious funerary rites or culturally appropriate funerary rites, whether there's even burial grounds where they can be laid to rest with other Muslims, let's say, whether they decide to repatriate to ancestral soils, and so on. So there's a host of questions. And there's a great number of such decisions that families with migratory histories have to make, which, in my view, illuminates a great deal about their sense of place, including their ideas about home and homeland, about citizenship and belonging, about national and religious identity in a transnational and multicultural and multi-confessional world. And while death is undoubtedly a universally shared human experience, maybe the most universally shared experience, other than birth, perhaps, it poses distinct challenges for minority communities in migratory settings. Right? It foregrounds these deep questions that are really central to the intergenerational experience of migration. You know, who am I? Where do I belong? And the act of burial, I argue, confers a final sense of fixity to identities that are more fluid and ambivalent in life. In the book, I try to show that in situations where the boundaries of the nation and its members are contested, that burial decisions are actually political acts, since they are means to assert belonging, attachment, and maybe even loyalty to a particular country, community, or place. And I illustrate how different actors, including states, including religious communities, and families, all have a vested interest in the fate of dead bodies, including where they go and how they're memorialized. So I try to trace the actors, networks, and institutions that facilitate, encourage, or obstruct the movement of dead bodies within and across borders to illustrate the complexity of the field within which these posthumous mobilities enfold.
Yeah, I really appreciate that. And my next question actually centers on posthumous mobility. So, you know, in my reading, the book really tracks the afterlives of migration through careful attention to how burials are handled within the city of Berlin or to the repatriation of bodies. So there are multiple, you know, scales or forms of mobility going on. And I'm curious, how does religious difference become reinscribed by and impact posthumous mobilities?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, there's different factors, you know, religion is one of them, but there's a different factors, I think, that influence burial decisions, that I try to outline in the book, factors such as family ties, the different meanings that people attribute to particular soils, and also feelings of social exclusion, whether or not individuals feel discriminated against or they feel like they belong in the national community. These I trace out and sort of outline in the book through interviews. I try to put a lot of interview excerpts where people are explaining their different preferences, reflecting on them, reflecting on the decisions of others to try to tease out the different meanings and factors influencing burial decisions and outcomes. Of course, there's also the kind of practical dimension of this, such as, the laws governing dead bodies and funerary rites. For example, in Germany, there's a mandatory 48-hour waiting period between death and burial, which in practice can actually be much longer if the state needs to conduct an autopsy or if there's any indication of foul play in the death, right? So that the corpse can be kept waiting. But in Islam, most Muslims believe that the dead should be buried as quickly as possible after death, which people have interpreted as essentially a 24-hour rule, although it's not specified anywhere what the actual time period should be. Most people say that you should be buried on the same day or within 24 hours of your death. That's because the corpse is believed to still be sentient and to feel pain until it's put into the earth. So there's some, you know, conflicts between, you know, funerary laws and Islamic beliefs. There's also the practical question. I think this is like a big question, and this is a way of, you know, how we can think about differences is inscribed in posthumous practices. The big issue is that there's really a lack of cemetery space available for Muslims to bury their dead. In Germany, the cemeteries are all publicly owned, municipally administered, and of the something like 32,000 burial grounds in Germany, less than 1% have spaces reserved for Muslim burials. So Muslims, like members of other religions, bury, you know, close to each other, right? There's specific requirements such as burial without a coffin, which is not always possible or legally permissible in Germany. Burying with the body facing towards Mecca, which is possible to align the graves in this manner. But the sheer lack of availability of burial grounds for Muslims is actually a big public policy challenge, not just in Germany, but across Europe. This is something that came to light, especially during the coronavirus pandemic, and when Muslim communities were hit by the virus, some imams in places like France tried to come up with creative solutions when there weren't actual cemetery spaces available for Muslims, such as issuing fatwas saying that a Muslim could be buried in a non-Muslim burial ground, later exhumed if necessary. Or in one case, there was a fatwa issued by a group of imams in Lyon, which said that the COVID dead were to be considered martyrs and they could be buried anywhere they died. As martyrs, they weren't subject to the same sort of requirements for ordinary Muslims. So there's a way in which this, there's these kind of practical considerations, but there's also, one of the chapters in the book is a visual ethnography. I think we'll might come to that a little later. A visual ethnography of the what I call Europe's Islamic deathscapes, right? So I'm trying to trace representations of personhood and identity through semiotic analyses of tombstone, paying particular attention to visual and architectural markers of difference and alterity. People display and perform these different attachments and identities in different ways. And religion is sort of one factor, where graves are Islamized by the use of particular, religious language, such as the Fatiha inscription of the, Fatiha, or, through crescent moons, or even in tombstones shaped like mini mosques, which was kind of a striking feature of the cemetery landscape. So.
Yeah, I love how you also show us that, practices or norms around death are never settled, right? They're never fixed, but constantly being mediated. And in fact, mediators of posthumous mobilities take an important part in your book. So what is at stake in the mediation of transnational or urban deathways?
So there's a number of mediators, there's a number of different actors. As I was mentioning earlier, the goal was to try to, illustrate and make sense of the complexity of this field of transnational death and dying. So there's a number of private actors, there's a number of state actors, there's a number of civil society associations at work. So one of the chapters in the book looks at the role of Islamic civil society associations and their funeral funds. So the Islamic funeral funds are basically membership organizations. Well, these are funeral funds that are administered by longstanding Islamic civil society associations in Europe. And the two that I look at in the book, although there are many more, and it would be interesting to do a sort of a deeper comparison of the different funds and their activities and operations and the kind of incentives that they provide. But the two that I look at are the two largest and sort of longest standing, most well-established Islamic civil society associations. One of them is called DİTİB, and this is connected to the Turkish Ministry of Religious Affairs. So this is the European branch of the Turkish Ministry of Religious Affairs. For those who follow Turkey, this is the most important political institution that structures the relationship between religion and the state. Oversees, you know, the training of imams in Turkey, oversees the printing of religious textbooks and, you know, dictates the content of the Friday sermons at the mosques. So this is a big regulatory body that is mediating the relationship between the Turkish state and the practice of Islam in the public sphere. They set up a European office in the early 80s and, you know, alongside other activities such as the organization of Hajj pilgrimages or Eid celebrations or Quran courses or, you know, job training or language training, these kind of things. One of the services they offer is a funeral fund. And this is a fund whereby you pay an annual membership fee. And if you keep paying your fees, when you die, the fund will assign a funeral company to take care of all of the logistical and bureaucratic, steps leading up to burial or repatriation. So this is one of the funds I look at. The second one is connected to a group that's associated with a party called Milli Görüş in Turkey. This is a party started by Necmettin Erbakan, and it's an Islamist party that's had many different lives and iterations in Turkish politics over the decades. It's been sort of closed and reopened under a new name. But this is a fund started by followers of Milli Görüş called UKPA. And between the two funds, they have a combined membership of about 500,000 members across Europe. So their activities span, in at least a dozen Western European countries. I was looking primarily at their activities in Germany, but they have branches in England, France, Sweden, Denmark. You know, wherever you go, you can find these funeral funds. And, I saw that they were, you know, important actors in determining where the bodies go and what they signify. In many cases, like, you know, one of the important considerations for people is always an economic consideration. How much is this going to cost, right? So burial in Germany is pretty expensive. It can be a few thousand euros and the grave lease is only for, you know, at a minimum 5 years, maximum 20 years. It can be renewed a couple of times before the grave is recycled. But, you know, DİTİB's fund, for example, didn't cover the costs associated with local burial in Germany, right, or in the other countries that it operates in. But it would pay the full cost of burial if the individual was repatriated to Turkey. And, you know, it would also give a companion round trip airfare ticket for someone to accompany the body to its final destination. So it did provide these material incentives to incentivize repatriation. There's also a kind of a moralistic language used. You know, my chapter is based on close readings of membership contracts and sort of publicity and promotional literature made by the funds and some conversations with fund administrators, although I had a difficult time getting through in some cases. But there's this language of, you know, this Turkish term that you're familiar with called gurbet, which doesn't have a clean English translation, but I think it, you know, translates as to something like, you know, exile and homesickness combined, right? And so there's this language used in the membership fund literature saying, you know, out of this condition of living in gurbet, we've institutionalized this fund. to help our members deal with dying in this country that they don't necessarily feel at home. So looking at these different logics, you know, I try to argue that there is a moral and material incentivization of repatriation by the funeral funds, and so that they're one of the sort of prime actors in producing some kind of a, you know, diasporic engagement, diasporic nationalism, or kind of maintaining affective ties to Turkey, right? So there's a lot at stake in cultivating continued attachments to the homeland, right? And these are, through the practice of repatriating bodies, I read this as one kind of important symbolic act of reaffirming, you know, ideas about home and the homeland. The other set of actors are the undertakers. So the bulk of my ethnographic work was with Muslim undertakers in Berlin. I worked as an undertaker. I was an apprentice to them. I shadowed them. I participated in every aspect of their day-to-day work, preparing bodies for local burial or repatriation, visiting the bureaucratic offices, the consular offices, delivering coffins to the airport to be loaded on cargo or commercial flights. And so I got to observe them in action. I got to do a sort of participant observation of the work of undertaking, and sat down with them for many long formal interviews, but also just kind of countless conversations on the job where I was asking questions and, you know, trying to understand what was going on. And I view them, you know, this is not unique to undertaking, I think, but, you know, there's a lot of immigrant entrepreneurs that serve as cultural brokers or cultural mediators. But in the kind of field of death or the bureaucracy of death, you know, the undertakers were these really important mediators between Muslim families and the state. They help guide families through the different, you know, legal, cultural, religious, political landscapes that structure transitions from life to death. And they help to reconcile sometimes, you know, conflicting or competing sets of administrative or cultural norms, like what I was saying earlier about the 48-hour mandatory waiting period, or, you know, mandatory burial with a coffin rather than a shroud, or these kind of things. So they served as mediators by, you know, offering lessons about Muslim citizens to the German state, in the sense of, through their interactions with the civil servants and the bureaucrats and all of the actors that are involved in the bureaucracy of death, of which there are many. It's an overly bureaucratized field, right? This countless, different paperwork that has to be put in order, and it all has to come in a particular order. First getting the death certificate, and then unregistering the individual, and then going back to all these different offices. So it's a lot of running around. And so they meet different civil servants and bureaucrats in the course of their work. And I saw them as serving as mediators by dispelling and countering derogatory stereotypes about Islam and Muslims in Germany. This was one aspect. The other was serving as cultural mediators with Muslim families whose, you know, knowledge of the bureaucratic order was, for the undertakers, a kind of reflection of their level of integration, let's say. And so they were had this kind of pedagogical function where they were teaching lessons about the state to minority citizens, but also teaching lessons about minority citizens to the state. And, you know, their own authority was premised upon their knowledge of the bureaucratic order. But I also found that they internalized certain, logics of, you know, what we would understand as the Weberian legal rational, hellscape, maybe, of rules and laws and regulations and red tape and paperwork and so on. So they were very fascinating characters. And, you know, I these are basically the institutional actors, the funeral funds, and then the kind of private actors, these Muslim funeral homes. And I should say, The very existence of an Islamic funeral industry in Germany is a novel consequence of migration, right? These are entrepreneurs who entered a field which they saw, you know, not a lot of funerary services catering to Muslims. Most of them didn't have a background in undertaking, you know, they had various jobs before that. And so there was, you know, it's kind of a new field, right, from the 90s forward. I think the first funeral home in Berlin, which was called Vatan Cenaze, it was built in 1983, was established in 83. But since then, they've proliferated, and there's a whole kind of market around Muslim funerals.
Yeah. Yeah, this is so fascinating. And you mentioned home. So my next question is, I guess a question that appeared for me related to home as I read the book. So throughout your fieldwork, you follow Turks, Kurds, and Alevis who are differently positioned vis-a-vis so-called home. For example, for one of your interlocutors from Dersim, repatriation is out of question due to war and destruction, whereas for Turks, repatriation can become a sort of necropatriotism, to borrow from your words. So I'm curious about how you locate the Turkish state in Death Out of Place, or whether you see Death Out of Place as something that impacts Muslim migrants in Germany unevenly.
Yeah, that's another great question. You know, I mentioned earlier that I read these burial decisions as political acts. So, you know, where and how an individual is buried and commemorated, right? This is a political act that signifies or says something about certain values and attachments and beliefs. Now, as you point out, repatriation is not always possible or plausible for certain minorities. Local burial may not be possible or plausible for others. One story that came out of the field work was that, for example, the Alevi community, which is a religious minority in Turkey that has had a turbulent relationship with the Sunni majority, a lot of these conflicts, you know, are transnationalized when people move across borders and you know, establish communities in the diaspora. So the conflicts don't necessarily resolve themselves or go away. They just move and have new forms. So one story that I heard from two of Alevi religious leaders was that they had to essentially establish their own mortuary services and company, including, you know, their own cold storage space for a morgue. They buy their own, you know, vans for transportation, establish their own undertakers because they face challenges by, you know, either they couldn't bring their bodies to the mosque, right, for Friday prayer or for a funerary prayer, I mean. Or the undertakers may refuse service outright. I don't know if these were apocryphal or not, but they said that part of the logic of establishing their own funerary services and their own religious centers, right, was because of this sectarian conflict that, you know, traveled with them into Germany, right? So you see this reflected in the rituals around death as well. But with these questions of necropatriotism, which is a concept that I try to develop in the book, which speaks to the link between the dead body and the soil and ideas about the nation, right? I read repatriation in one sense as a kind of fulfillment of this myth of return that accompanies a lot of migratory journeys, but is not always fulfilled in practice. This idea of a glorious homecoming after, you know, years in exile, right? But this, you know, this image of the glorious homecoming is often, you know, kind of a myth, right? The homecomings aren't always as people would expect them to. Let's just put it that way. And what I found fascinating was that even, you know, some of my Kurdish interlocutors, right, thought that repatriation was actually a desirable situation, right, in the absence of a Kurdish state, right, because this would, you know, help to maintain the attachments to an imaginary Kurdistan. Let's say that was in existence as a political community, but One of my interlocutors, who was someone who had been living in as a political asylee in Germany, who is a active member in the Kurdish struggle, said that, this isn't nationalism. You should be, buried where you're born. And for me, this means sending the body back to Kurdistan. So for him, it was the almost calling into being a yet imaginary political community and sending back the bodies as a way to sort of mark claim over that territory, right? Some of the Alevi leaders said the same thing about repatriation. They said that, that I know my great-great-grandfather's grave, and when I go there, I see 250 years of history, and I don't have to ask anyone. It's there before me. And for us Alevis, this is this kind of genealogical continuity. It's very important, right? It's part of our heritage, our tradition, our culture. And I want my children to learn about this. And so I want my body to be repatriated there too, so that they can maintain an attachment to the homeland and so on. For others, the idea of, local burial, families impact these decisions in both in like kind of a Janus-faced way, right? Both forward-looking and backward-looking. So some people, the dead body, is anchored by their ancestors. I want to be close to my ancestors so we can have this genealogical continuity, family continuity, attachment to a particular place, a homeland, which is made meaningful by virtue of the dead that lay within it, right? For others, it's more kind of forward-looking. The dead are anchored by their children, right? So they say, my children are here, my grandchildren will be here. This is our home now. I want to be buried here so that my children have no doubt about where they belong. It's here in Germany, which is where we've settled. So through these different practices, right, I saw a lot of these as kind of placemaking practices, claims making through, burial practices, and signifying a particular attachment to a place or a political community by virtue of burying your dead within it. So those were some of the, but it's not always obvious which way it's going to go, right? And so I don't have a kind of a neat causal argument about what will happen if one is of a certain sect or minority or class or gender or all these other factors which may play a role. I think it's a very personal decision, and the reasons that people give me often conflict with one another, right? They contradict one another, they're messy. The most obvious one is if you're going to repatriate a body, it's going to take more than 24 hours, right? So if you're a practicing Muslim, you want the body to be buried as soon as possible after death. But I found that a lot of people were willing to suspend this religious injunction because they felt that it was more important to get the body back to the right place, right? So death out of place, return the body right to the proper place, restoring the kind of, the broken circle. So in a lot of ways, these logics come into conflict with each other. And what I try to do there is to, tease out the different, ways that people justified, made sense of these practices, given their different subject positions and positioning in German society.
Yeah,
or Turkish society.
Yeah, absolutely. As a reader, I really appreciated how your book really lays out this messiness, and I think it's so important to do. And something that was interesting to me was how political tensions in Turkey also traveled with you during your fieldwork, and we see that come into view, especially when you mention your affiliation with the University of Pennsylvania. So maybe we can talk a little bit about what Pennsylvania means for Turkish or migrants from Turkey in Germany. And can you tell us about how these tensions shaped your methodology?
Sure. So I started my field work in 2013 first trip to Berlin, and the field work was conducted between 2013 and 2017, 15 discontinuous months over a 4-year period. In 2016, there was an attempted military coup in Turkey, in which several hundred people were killed, and the aftermath of which was a large purge of suspected Gülenists within the AKP government. So Fethullah Gülen is an exiled cleric living somewhere up in the Poconos in the state of Pennsylvania. And he has a sort of a long and uneven history in Turkish politics, at one time ally of Erdogan, then falling out of power, then kind of suspected of being the mastermind of the military coup, and suspected of basically putting his cronies, infiltrating all levels of the state, from the judiciary to the police and so on. And so there was a real kind of internal conflict between followers of Erdogan and Gülen, and the Gülenists, whose activities span all sorts of different things, such as starting schools and religious charities and interfaith dialogues and these kind of things. So. When I first got to Berlin, there wasn't kind of an open conflict period between the Gülenists and the followers of Erdogan. But Pennsylvania, which is where Gülen resides, to my I wasn't expecting this, but this is essentially like a metonym for the Gülen movement. So there was an encounter that I had earlier in, my early days in the field, where I was, in the courtyard of a mosque trying to get an interview with the imam there, who asked me about my affiliation. And when I gave him my business card, which said PhD student at the University of Pennsylvania, he was pretty skeptical about my credentials and what I represented. And I didn't quite get it at first, but I realized that he suspected some kind of affiliation with the movement, because in the aftermath of the military coup, especially in a lot of the public messaging, Erdogan spoke about the man in Pennsylvania, or simply he would say, "Pennsylvania, I have a message for you." So Pennsylvania is the most notorious American state, probably in Turkey, the most well-known and infamous state. And so, that was a moment where I, for reasons that would have been, maybe I could have predicted this, but it taught me a lesson about, our own positionality as researchers. I mean, I told you a little bit about my background as a Turkish American. I wasn't as familiar with Turkish diasporic life in Germany. So there's definitely a politics that preceded me. I knew about the various sectarian conflicts or conflicts between leftist groups in the diaspora versus more nationalist groups. But I didn't anticipate that, the UPenn thing would be an issue. And so we all make kind of early mistakes, I think, in the field that then later shape our research trajectory. This taught me that, there's very little that one can assume about how we're made legible by others, about the kind of different markers that are going to stand out to them, what aspects of our, presumed identity will be, most encouraging or most discouraging for them. And, I always tried to be truthful with my interlocutors, to explain my intentions, that this was for a research project, for a dissertation, right? That I wasn't a journalist. A lot of people were concerned that this would be a kind of a newspaper thing with a wide readership. But I said, don't worry, nobody's going to read this. So it's just a dissertation. You don't have to worry about anything. But to be honest about my own intentions and to practice a kind of ethnographic sincerity, right? Because as I mentioned, our interlocutors are not just waiting for us to come and study them or something. They're always allowing us in calculated ways. And even when things go unexpected, I think if you can be truthful in how you portray your aims and objectives, that's the first step in winning trust. Doesn't mean everyone's going to trust you, even if you tell the truth about it all the time. But there is a climate of suspicion especially among, you know, racialized or minoritized communities that are the targets of state surveillance, that are the targets of integration policies, that are the targets of various, carceral or coercive interventions on behalf of the state. They're rightly suspicious that when someone from the outside comes around, even if they speak the same language, if they look the same way, they have a beard, whatever, that, you know, that maybe their intentions aren't forthright. So that's a big challenge for any, you know, all ethnographers out there know the, you know, difficulties of kind of entering the field, I guess, and establishing. And so word of mouth is usually a good way, you know, what we call snowball sampling, learning about the existence of others, being introduced to new people through our existing contacts. But you never know how you're going to be received and what, you know, markers might work against you. So that was a really humbling moment for me, I think, in the field, and made me a little bit more cautious, a little bit more guarded. Even though I didn't modify my story, it was just to learn that the politics that preceded me could play out in really unexpected ways that would be, difficult to deal with in the moment. But that was a valuable lesson about this kind of micro diasporic politics and all the intricacies and complexities of doing transnational research.
Of course, and thanks for sharing that with us. Another aspect of your fieldwork I was curious about concerns your work as an undertaker. So, you know, you mentioned the kinds of labor that job entails, but to my mind, you know, it also involves a strange intimacy. So you've been present in maybe some of the most, you know, difficult days of some people's lives, of strangers. So I'm curious about whether emotions or intimacy figured into your methodological approach.
Yeah, I thought about this a lot, and I had a lot of self-doubts about the work I was doing and whether or not, you know, this could be just considered voyeuristic or that, you know, insensitive to be, you know, in these environments as a stranger, as an outsider. The undertakers were extremely receptive and open and you know, included me basically in everything and treated me as one of their own. And in fact, there were situations where a family member at a funeral would come up and ask me a question, right, that maybe I didn't have the answer for because I was with them and I was helping them. And so, you know, they naturally thought that, you know, I was part of that team, and in which case I would refer them back to the undertakers themselves. But it's impossible not to let the emotions impact you in these moments. I'm actually working through right now a methodological piece around, you know, other people's grief and studying grief ethnographically, where I'm trying to develop some ideas about vulnerability, especially collective vulnerability, the kind of collective vulnerability that arises in these moments of mourning and grief and rituals around death and burial. I was participating in these rituals. I was praying with the family members. I was, you know, working with the undertakers. And that subject-object distinction, which I think is already, an unhelpful sort of binary, becomes completely blurred in these moments of collective ritual. Like, this doesn't mean like going native or giving yourself up to the ecstasy of the collective frenzy, but it just means recognizing that you are a human being in a situation with other human beings whose community is in a moment of grief and suffering and is going through some kind of a ritual that is going to maybe repair or begin to address some of the wounds and maybe be a moment of healing and closure. And there's no doubt that it's difficult and painful, and, you know, I was overcome with emotion on several occasions, and I didn't try to downplay that. I write about my own, you know, experiences through a series of vignettes and field notes that you know, open up the different chapters of the different books, but trying to have that embodied ethnographic experience to try to convey it, right? I felt that it was, you know, it was a difficult position to be in, of course. I mean, I'm not going to say it was like I could just go there and put on, you know, I'm a rational, objective observer, and I'm just going to sit and watch all of this and just, you know, not feel anything. Maybe some people can do that, but I didn't feel as though that would be helpful. And so you have all kinds of methodological issues maybe that arise then about objectivity and relationality and the kind of intersubjective forms of knowledge production. But, you know, for me, again, going back to that point about rapport and trust, right? I think it would have been weird had I been standing in the corner with a notepad just taking notes while all of this was happening. So, you know, I tried to enter those rituals humble, right? Like not taking the you know, kind of following the cues of the undertakers, right? And letting them guide it, but also being cognizant of the fact that I was participating as both an observer of these rituals, but also as a participant in them, right? Taking part in the collective prayers for the deceased, for example, right? Speaking with the family members, right? Trying my best to play these different roles. And it was emotionally draining. You know, it's not easy to attend a funeral, and it was draining to write the notes up afterwards, right? And they would come at unexpected times. I'd get a phone call, you know, midnight saying, okay, be here at, you know, 5:30 a.m. tomorrow to go, you know, to prepare for this. So I get a call in the middle of the day. So we never really prepared, right? But I try to write this in, these kind of reflections on my own positionality as a participant and observer in these rituals, and to think through the kind of, you know, in this new piece that I'm working on, the kind of collective vulnerabilities that are produced in these moments of public rituals of mourning and grief, and how this, you know, shapes our understanding and experience of the event that is taking place.
Yeah, I mean, I can imagine how draining it can be, and I appreciate your vulnerability in sharing this with our listeners as well. So, you know, I also would really love to learn more about the afterlives of the book. So I know that you just came back from a series of book talks in Europe. Was there anything that surprised you or that you enjoyed about the book's reception so far?
Right. So I've just gotten back from a few talks, and it's been really wonderful to be able to share my work with audiences in Europe, and also with your listeners on this podcast. I'm finding that, you know, it's been generative. The work has produced a lot of conversations, and that people are very keen to try to draw comparisons to what is happening locally for them. So I was in the UK giving a talk at Cambridge. A lot of discussion was, you know, focused around cemeteries and cemetery plots for Muslims in the UK, or British Muslim undertakers, or the kind of, you know, different logics that might accompany kind of post-colonial migrations to the UK, right, versus, you know, non-colonial in the sense of Turkey and Germany, right? And so I gave a talk in Paris, right, where I got to connect with some colleagues in France who were very interested in issues surrounding North African Muslim communities living in France, and, you know, the same questions around cemeteries and undertakers. And lastly, I was in Copenhagen. And there too, I mean, I think, you know, there is much work to be done here. And there are several authors and some of my co-authors who have written about these different cases. But I think this is a topic that lends itself to a great deal of comparative research. what I'm finding striking is that there's more similarities and differences in the experiences that I'm hearing about death out of place, right? I really do think there's something universal about, you know, this experience of dying in a country that you don't necessarily feel at home in for different migrant communities, right? Be they the subjects of empire, or be they, you know, displaced for other reasons, be they refugees, or be they border crossers for other reasons. So I'm very curious to see, you know, as more people hopefully learn about this study and the questions that are motivating it, I'm very interested to see how different scholars are going to pick up and do their studies, their own local studies, to maybe tease out some of these similarities and differences, and how different communities, different subject positions navigate these really complex and deeply profoundly political questions around death and dying. So that work is, I think that work is yet to come. One thing that I'm working on collaboratively now with some scholars is a website, dyingabroad.com, which it's not live yet, but there I hope to have as a repository for the images of the tombstones that I've taken myself and that other researchers who are interested in these transnational deathways. You know, I'd like to chronicle the diversity of afterlives that are present in multicultural cemeteries across Western Europe and beyond. So this is something that I've been sort of speaking with colleagues on the tour too. So there's more to come, I hope.
Wow, this is so exciting. And I personally will be looking forward to the website. But on the note of things to look forward to, my last question is, what is next for you? What are you currently reading, writing, thinking, or teaching about?
Well, I have another book project that I'd like to get off the ground around memory, collective memory and political violence. So I've written a couple of standalone pieces, essentially looking at, you know, how do states deal with the bodies of the perpetrators and victims of acts of political violence and terrorism, looking at cases like Charlie Hebdo shootings in France, or the Boston Marathon bombing, or the creation of the Cemetery of Traitors in Turkey following the failed military coup in 2016. And here I'm interested especially in the more kind of collective acts of mourning and ritualization, and how states and their contenders commemorate and memorialize actors, right, in different ways to shore up certain ideas about the boundaries of national communities and who is included in them and what they stand for and so on. So I have a couple of case studies that I'm developing now, and I hope to bring this all together into a book in the next couple of years that's going to center more around, you know, if we could make a distinction between the kind of quotidian modes of transnational death and dying. Maybe these are kind of more exceptional moments where moments of political violence and terrorism, which, while exceptional, are still sort of spectacular moments or moments of spectacle where different ideas about the political community and its boundaries are expressed and contested through these public rituals of grief, commemoration, and mourning. So I'm moving in sort of this direction next, and there's a lot of great scholars that have written on these topics. So I'm in the phase of kind of reading and thinking right now. So that's what's going on. Fortunately, it's the summer, so I have a little bit more time to read now.
Wow, this is very exciting. And hopefully when you finish that book, we'll have you back on the podcast.
Yes, inshallah.
Inshallah, indeed. Thank you very much, Osman, for joining us and for your insights.
Okay, thank you very much. I really appreciate this invitation, and it's been a wonderful set of questions that made me think really hard, actually, about what I was writing in the book. So thank you very much to you as well, Elisa, for your close and thorough reading of the book. I really appreciate that.
Oh, the pleasure was all mine. This is your host, Eliza Erjan. This discussion of Dying Abroad, The Political Afterlives of Migration in Europe, published by Cambridge University Press in 2023, is brought to you by the New Books Network in association with the Mobilities and Methods Lab at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Thank you for listening.